profits we must pay for. From the cities to the farmlands and trenches full of mud. Cause war has always been the boss's way, sir. Come on!
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the announcement last week, some 15,000 GM workers going to lose their jobs thanks to the decision to shut down five plants across the U.S. One of them, four plants across the U.S., one in Canada. One, the historic Lordstown plant that I drive by. In fact, you know, this coming weekend, I will be driving back to Cleveland to visit family for an event, and we're going to go right past the Lordstown plant, which, you know, you can tell how the economy's kind of going by how many cars are in that parking lot, and the thought of it being shut down is quite distressing, especially given the historic nature of that facility and the struggles that they've endured over the past. And here to share some thoughts on, well, the shutdown and also the history of the Lordstown plant, I've asked Eric Loomis to come talk with us, historian, professor, and author of the book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Did I lose him?
You Rick, there? Can you hear? Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep. Thanks for taking time for us, Eric.
Oh, you bet. I'm glad to be here.
So, you know, I look at this announcement and really a shot in the gut to working people, especially in the auto industry after, you know, the bailout and after concession. Curious your thoughts to start.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's tremendously sad. It also makes me very angry. I think you're absolutely right that the workers have given so much over the years and done so much to try to keep the industry competitive and keep some of these jobs in the United States. But it's been clear for a long time that GM, as well as Ford and Chrysler, have very little interest in keeping any of these jobs in the United States. I think they would outsource all of them if they could. And they've made choices over which cars are going to be produced in which factories, and they have intentionally moved the most profitable vehicles overseas. And this has set up a situation where now they can shut down these plants, including, as you pointed out, in Lordstown.
Yeah, and again, I look back to the Lordstown plant, and the history of that plant is, you know, another one of those things that, you know, you think back to the speed ups, and you think back to the historic strike in 72, I think it was, and you that helped build a prosperous working class and helped help those workers and all workers, and you know, to see us going the other direction is kind of, well, it's distressing.
It's infuriating, and. You know, I think it says a lot about where the economy's come since 1972. You know, in my book, that's the focus of Chapter 8 is the Lordstown strike. And I think it represents how in the early 1970s, when American workers still believed that the future was ahead of them, that workers were making new demands on their employers. They were demanding not only better wages and hours, but those Lordstown workers were demanding, you know, a stay in production. They are demanding dignity on the job. They are demanding whole new things that their forefathers couldn't have imagined. And you're really seeing that at that time in the early 70s through many industries. All kinds of new demands are being made of employers. And after 1973, with the first of the recessions and then into the 80s and the beginning of modern union busting, you see the ability of these workers, the dreams of these workers for a better life get smaller and smaller and smaller as they're getting attacked from outsourcing and from automation and from speed ups and from every other thing that is creating the economic inequality that we see today. And the closing of this plant is really the end of an era, the end of an era of industrialization, the end of an era of working class demands, the end of an era of working class dignity. So I'm both sad but also furious at GM for doing that.
As we should be. And you make an interesting point that, you know, there was a period that, you know, we could fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and things would be better in the future. And now I keep saying, you know, everybody I talk to, well, I'm just happy to have a job, Eric. We can't ask for too much. We can't ask for too high a minimum wage. Or they'll automate. We can't ask, you know, for better health care or they'll move offshore. We can't demand anything too much because the bosses won't like it.
Yeah, and I think that we have to change our demands in some ways. I mean, I think that what's happening with GM, and it's happened to so many industries over the last 30 or 40 years in this country, shows that we need new demands, not just from employers, but from the government. You know, demands for a government job guarantee, as some senators have come out for, potentially demands for something like a universal income, demands for national health care, demands that recreate the kind of vision of dignity for all Americans that at their best unions represented and now no longer can, because they've just been attacked and decimated so much. And so I think that what's really happening here is we're about to have to move into a new era where our demands as everyday people, to some extent, are still about the workplace, but the demands are not just with the employers, but have to go higher than that, have to demand a whole new political system and a new way of responding to everyday workers, because the struggles that people have are so profound now. And with every time, you know, GM or Ford or whoever decides to just move more jobs overseas, it just undermines that working class dignity just one step further, to the point that there's not too much left. And I think that, you know, I think inevitably you're going to see another recession come. And I really worry about what happens at that moment, because I think a lot of people are fooling themselves that we have a healthy economy today. But for everyday workers, it's not a healthy economy. It's a struggle.
No. I mean, you know, most people that I talk to, they're struggling to make ends meet, and you know, wages haven't gone up. I mean, if you're at the top, if you're at the technology boom up at the top, you're in the, you know, the top 10-15%. You're doing really well. But if you're punching a clock, you're a, you know, working class stiff who's, one of the ham and eggers. You're struggling because healthcare costs are getting completely out of hand. And I haven't talked to a person yet who doesn't say, you know, healthcare is a struggle. And that's, again, another one of these things, another failure of our political system to address the needs of we the people.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think that the inability of the political world to respond to this is also very highly distressing. I mean, you know, you talk about something like healthcare, and it's, as you say, completely out of control. And you know, what is the future going to be for the American working class is a question that I think we're finally beginning to take seriously after a very, very, very long time of not really taking it seriously. And you know, it infuriates me that we see all this commentary about, oh, the economy's so doing so well, look at unemployment rates, they're so low, and how easily people, especially people in power, are willing to pat themselves on the back for the economy they've created, completely ignoring the number of people who are working three jobs, the number of people who are having to leave their kids home alone because they don't have the money for childcare, people who can't go to the doctor, or people who are spending an enormous amount of their income on healthcare. This is not a healthy economy. This is an economy that is giving people minimal jobs when it's supposedly at an era of peak performance. And so once we inevitably fall off that peak performance, the amount of suffering that is going to come is going to be really unbelievable, and I think we'll really shake up this political class.
Now, I mean, for the majority of working people in this country, if this is the best it gets, a lot to be desired.
That's exactly right, and I think that in some ways, you know, the fights right now, the fights for higher minimum wages and some of the other strikes that are going on and things like this, I think are setting the groundwork for these larger demands that are going to have to come during the next recession. And I am optimistic that we are moving in the right direction as far as creating new kinds of demands and a political movement ready to act on that in a way that has not existed really maybe since the 1970s. So
yeah.
I am cautiously optimistic, but concerned at the same time.
Yeah, that was my next line of questioning is because, you know, at the end of this, you know, we saw in West Virginia teachers, you know, taking to the streets. We saw in places like Kentucky and Arizona, Oklahoma, this kind of what is, you can tell, is this uneasiness, this frustration and a willingness to move forward. Do you see that going on? I mean, I had thought after the Bush collapse in 2008 into 2009 that we were ready for, you know, kind of, you know, mass demands. Do you see that coming in the future? I mean, given the fact that our labor laws are so badly antiquated and calcified, the fact that, you know, the corporate power has swung so far to the extreme, do you see that? Do you see that playing out?
Well, look, there's no question that you're absolutely right about labor law, about the court. All of these things are massive problems that we face, and there's no denying that. However, I do think that, you know, part of the reason that we did not see longer term reforms after the Bush collapse and during the Great Recession is that demands had been, you know, demands from the left had been so marginalized for so long, and so many people believed in the kind of Clinton era Democratic Party of neoliberalism and privatization, and, you know, kind of the third way democratic centrism and all of this, that the left itself was really not ready to respond when the Great Recession took place, that the ideas of the left had not rejuvenated. You had not seen an active intellectual conversation happening on the left. And I think that that began to happen with Occupy. And I think that that has moved now into so many different directions, the Bernie Sanders campaign being a great example of this. You know, people like Ocasio-Cortez and some of these other grassroots members of Congress that have been elected, these new ideas that are popping up around again, like, you know, free college, federal job guarantee, all of these demands that would have been unthinkable by Democratic politicians even 4 to 6 years ago.
Yeah, $15 an hour minimum wage.
Exactly. And so I think the left has done a lot of the intellectual work to revive itself, to begin to articulate demands, and that when that next recession comes, you're going to see a resistance movement much more advanced, both intellectually and with a political agenda, than you did in 2008, 2009, when really the only option anybody saw was kind of getting behind the Obama campaign, which proved to be of limited success for working people.
Yeah, and again, you know, I still go back to that period where I would have liked to have seen something better than the Employee Free Choice Act, and yet all we got was Lilly Ledbetter.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's incredibly disappointing, and I think that I do think that a lot of these demands are coming, it's interesting, from outside the labor movement, you know, that labor law may not be at the top of the reform the next time Democrats take power, and that's a problem, but I also think there's also a different kind of economic populism on the rise that have demands that is not necessarily that associated with the union movement per se, but are demands that would make a major difference in the lives of American workers. And so, you know, I think there's reason to be a little bit optimistic and pessimistic at the same time.
Do you think there's room for the labor movement? I mean, or have they been viewed as, you know, old and antiquated? And, you know, because I hear it all the time, you know, we needed, you know, unions 100 years ago, Eric.
Well, you know, there is a huge need for the labor movement. And you know, I mean, I think that public support for unions, when that's polled, it gets consistently pretty high. I mean, certainly you do see, especially middle and upper class people, including middle and upper class liberals, make these arguments that unions aren't necessary anymore. And that's obviously absurd given the reality of life for the reality of economic life for everyday workers. I mean, you know, unions are more needed than ever. And the problem, of course, being that the courts now are basically making what unions traditionally do as you know, illegal as they can through, you know, the Janus case and other cases that are going to be coming down the pike. And so I think that the problem is that the structures around unions are going to be so constricted that I think we're entering a period like we saw a century ago where the courts are just going to rule a lot of things unconstitutional based on the fact that they just don't like unions. And that's a huge problem that we face. But at the same time, the public demands for economic justice are also growing. And so somewhere the tension on that has to break.
Yeah, I mean, I've been saying for a while, we're heading back to a new version of the Lochner era, especially with, you know, with people like Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the court, and throw Roberts, Alito, and Thomas in there, and we're right back.
Oh, I completely agree that the Lochner era is not, it's not just the future, it's the present. And it's going to take time, and it's going to take, I think that one thing that liberals on the left have done a poor job of compared to conservatives is that conservatives have been targeting court reform for decades. Republican voters vote for Republican politicians they don't like, necessarily understanding that a big reason for that is to dominate the courts. And courts have not been a reason that liberals or the left come out to vote. And we see the cost of that today with courts that are just increasingly dominated by right-wing extremists.
Yeah, you know, now, and I'm looking at this Marriott strike, it got a little bit of attention, and from all that I can tell, is a victory. I mean, you know, the idea of workers, you know, banding together, not an old concept, but I don't think outdated. And as I've said a number of times, every generation has to relearn the concept of solidarity. And I think that's got to be something that we start talking about. Some of those old ideas, make them new again.
No, I completely agree. I mean, I think that the Marriott strikers did a great job. I mean, you know, I live in Rhode Island, and so, you know, I'm in the Boston media orbit. And the brilliant PR play of getting the Yankees to cross the picket line, man, that was just a great, great play. That played so well in this media market. It got a ton of sympathy for those workers. And, you know, connecting it up to the most revered of New England institutions, the Red Sox. And I thought that was just brilliant. And I think that the strike, it did so well. It does seem to have been an almost total victory. And to some extent, it's because the demands were so straightforward. And so, I mean, obvious, you know, things like, you know, panic buttons in rooms to protect housekeepers from sexual assault and things like that. I mean, how can an employer deny that? And I think that they do a great job. They did a really wonderful job here. But on a broader scale, I completely agree with you that you know, in the end, change comes down to organizing, and organizing has not changed that much over the years. The basics of organizing remain, the basics of solidarity remain. And, you know, I am optimistic that this new generation is beginning to learn what solidarity really means. And I think for too long, in politics on the left, sometimes people define solidarity as, you know, what are you going to do for me, as opposed to what can I sacrifice for you? And I think that hopefully people are moving to a more correct definition of solidarity, banding together, because in the end, we're all facing the same oppressors. You know, we're all facing the racist, fascist, extremist version of capitalism that is the modern Republican Party. And even if we all respond to that in different ways, we're all facing a piece of this. And so in the end, banding together for a common cause of fighting all of these issues is something that is the ticket to defeating this horrible reality in which Americans face right now.
Yeah, you're right. And last question I've got for you, back to the GM situation. You know, I had said right after the announcement that, you know, GM, that the auto workers should immediately begin looking at a general strike, maybe, you know, doing what other countries do. You look at France, for instance, when they announce a shutdown, the workers occupy the plants, and in even some extreme cases, hold the executives hostage. And I was reminded that I live in the U.S.
Well, you know, it is unfortunate that American unions have been reluctant to take this kind of radical action. I mean, in the end, what on earth does the United Auto Workers have to lose at this point? Right? I mean, what tactic is going to work to keep those jobs in those factories? I mean, they've done everything possible and it hasn't worked. I think a large dose of radicalism would be incredibly valuable. And I hope that is coming, but I suspect it's going to come from outside the established labor movement rather than inside the established labor movement, where labor leaders just, you know, they're going to hold on to those last bits that they can. And I don't necessarily blame them for that, but it's not going to rebuild the American labor movement
either. Yeah, good point. The book, History of America and 10 Strikes, highly, highly suggested, written by Eric Loomis. Eric, always great talking with you. It's been too long. I got to have you back again sooner.
I would love to do it. Thank you so much, Rick.
Beautiful. Thanks so much, our good friend Eric Loomis. Again, the book, History of America and 10 Strikes. Make sure you pick it up. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Firefighters, my friend, and the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town.